'Twas the week before the holidays, and all through the house. Not a creature was stirring, except for Charlie and Teddy. Those boys won't stop stirring. The stockings were hung by the Zoom call with care, but soon it was realized that nothing was there. "Why, we've forgotten to get gifts," said Ella with a shout. "And isn't that what holiday times are about?" But before Caroline could explain the importance of friendship, they both heard their co-host fly in on a spaceship. "Why not give the gift of learning?" said Tom with a yelp, appearing before them to offer them help. "Give tidbits and factoids and knowledge galore, and three more synonyms, and then maybe more. Some science miscellaneous, some downright outrageous. Give the gift of learning, for learning's contagious." "That's a terrible gift," said Ella, speaking true. Not...
He knew what I was thinking.
"Not in real life," said Caroline, "but for a podcast, it'll do."
Aww.
Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today, we're doing something special. I haven't pitched this to you guys yet, but I like to think of this as the Hollern Days.
I don't think you want me to say anything.
I think you know how I feel. Based on how you wrote me in that, I think you know how I feel. So today... for the Hollern Days. Ooh, that really never rolls off the tongue.
No.
It looks so much better in writing. we've gathered around the fire and we've wrapped a bunch of fun facts for each other that will open up sort of like white elephant style to give each other and you all the gift of learning. And I noticed there's a few presents there in the pile that I don't remember wrapping. So we'll see what those are soon. My name's Tom, and I'm going to throw another log in the fireplace. Here we go. Whoop. That's just my monitor. Oh, God. Oh, boy.
You really committed to the bit, didn't you, Tom?
Oh, yeah. And my monitor is really...
Boy. Yeah, wow. We are seeing some stuff right now. My name's Caroline, and I'm going to bring the mugs of hot chocolate that we're all going to drink whilst we're opening our white
amazing.
Elephants.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And my name's Ella, and I brought myself because my presence is gift enough.
Oh, my God.
I feel like we should have seen that coming from you, Ella,
yeah. But
I really didn't.
All right. Should we get cracking? How do we decide who opens first? Rock, paper, scissors?
Yeah, okay. Let's do
sure.
that.
Sure.
Okay.
Why not?
Oh, yeah? All right.
Is this going to work?
All at once? All at once?
Okay.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
Oh.
Ooh, okay. All right. Me and Ella both did scissors.
And Caroline did paper, so once more.
Ready, and rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
I did rock, Tom did paper. He gets to open the first festive gift
Yay!
In the pile.
Aww.
All right, I'm going to do a random number generator from 1 to 11.
Tom would do, like, I'm going to pick a number because I want the number. Tom's here like, I'm going to do a random generator. I have no preferences.
I'm going to read the radioactive decay of this isotope and decide what the...
All right, let me see.
Oh, cover.
Unwrapping this back.
My God, Tom.
Oh, boy. I got, in 1700s England, gin was cheaper than beer, creating a gin craze where it is estimated that the average Londoner drank a staggering 14 gallons of gin a year. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I'm going to guess that's Ella's then, if that's Caroline.
That's got to be an Ella. Yeah.
That is my fact.
Hold on. 14 gallons a year, so that's over a gallon a month.
Yeah, there's 63 liters for those who use metric.
Hey, guys, gin and beer are not interchangeable. That's not, in case people aren't aware, that's not a one-to-one in terms of percentage.
So here's the background to this. In the late 1600s, King William III, or William of Orange, instituted the Corn Laws in England, which gave tax breaks on spirit production, basically made the taxation on gin almost non-existent.
Oh.
And Simon Ford, who's a co-founder of a gin company, which I will not disclose because I was not paid to do so, said in an article...
But if they offer it, we can redact this.
Yes, absolutely. He said in an article for Vine Pair, this led to a period in England that is often dubbed the gin craze, a period where a pint of gin was cheaper than a pint of beer. Gin distilling basically became this huge free-for-all because anyone could make it, because there was no regulation on it, with anything they wanted. Like things like turpentine, sulfuric acid, and sawdust sometimes found in gin.
I'm sorry, what?
Yep, and the High Constable of Holborn reported 7,066 gin shops in his patch alone, meaning that roughly one house in every five was a gin shop or some kind of spirit distillery.
Oh my god. I don't, you know how like corn manufacturing, like with like subsidies in the US, but that kind of made sense because then you have like corn-based products. I don't understand this supply and demand curve where it's like everyone's just drinking gin. Like I don't understand. I assume it was both like a cultural thing also along with just like the production of it, because
the main patrons of gin in the 1700s tended to be the working classes. Life in 1700s Britain was not very nice for the working class. So they often drank away their troubles. Typically, it was with beer for a long time. And then when gin became so cheap, it was gin. Because if obviously
it's
much stronger it is and unregulated. People were drinking so much that many people were getting very ill or dying.
And I'm sure the sawdust doesn't help.
No, not at all. So in Vine Pair, Eric Delanoy said, gin was blamed for the death of thousands by overconsumption, murder, negligence, and insanity, which incited measures to outlaw its production and consumption, but to little avail. And on top of that, gin was often called mother's ruin because it was blamed for mass neglect and death of infants at the hands of drunk mothers.
Oh my god.
What a festive holiday fact this is.
Wow.
In a famous etching by William Hogarth from the time called Gin Lane, you see the...
I'm sorry, a famous etching?
Yeah, it's like a black and white drawing, but it was... I don't know. Yeah.
You like, you scratch it out and then you put ink on it and then you... I
keep forgetting it is the 1700s, yeah. And then that like firmly places me there. Everyone and their horse knew about this famous etching.
Well, this famous etching by William Hogarth called Gin Lane depicts the horrors of what was going on. I'll put a link to this image in the show notes, but it shows people fighting, people passed out, a mother dropping her baby over a railing.
and so... this was all started by, what was it?
The corn laws that it was basically just meant that there was very little taxation on spirit distilling. And gin was just a particularly popular one in the UK at the time and still is. And this etching that he did, William Hogarth, was printed often alongside another etching called Beer Street, which depicts happy people peacefully enjoying their beer. Utopian society of beer drinkers,
wow.
Which is hilarious if you've ever been out in England on a Saturday night.
This, you know what this feels? This reminds me of those like Goofus and Gallant.
Oh yeah,
where it's like Goofus waits till the last minute to do his homework. Gallant does it on time, but in this one, it's like Goofus prepares a gin drink, and Gallant is pure and drinks beer.
Yeah.
Does the morally right thing.
So it was chaos. There were 8 parliamentary acts that tried to crack down on mother's ruin from 1729 to 1751. And the 8th act, the final act in 1751, raised the taxes and the fees for retails and licenses to reduce spirit consumption. They also promoted the consumption of beer and tea instead.
Of course they did. Of course they did.
But it wasn't until the 1830s that beer became cheaper than gin for the first time in over a century.
Oh my god!
Wow. Yeah.
That's so long! That's so long!
And things started to stabilize amongst the working class after this. And that's the end of the fact.
Oh, that is wild.
That is...
for 100 years. It's just such a long period in which
it's crazy.
This was happening. Such a like... feels like such a fascinating microcosm about like... because, you know... it's clear that the propaganda is making this seem like it's like a personal responsibility issue when it's like clearly it's about like taxation and
it's a much larger issue of society as a whole that was just made worse by this.
Right. It's also like, hey, why are these workers working so hard that they want to have so much gin?
Also under the impression that a lot of it was because especially like London drinking water was so grim at the time that it was safer to drink beer. I don't know how true that is, though.
So it is safer. It was safer to drink beer at the time. When I was looking up, when I remembered this fact, the fact I had in my head was that people were drinking gin because it was safer to drink than water. But I couldn't find anything to, like, necessarily back that up.
Ah, okay, sure. That makes sense.
It is widely known that drinking water, especially in London, was incredibly unsafe because of cholera. So I think there is some, like, truth there, but I don't know. I think that's probably more towards beer than gin.
Yeah.
There wasn't an etching that was like, God, also, don't drink the water. We're sorry. We'll get that right one day. That was a really fun trip back in time. But gin is also my favorite spirit, so... A fun fact that I'll be able to tell anytime it comes up. I'll be like, we should really instate that again, that policy. It works out in my favor. Yeah. Ella, would you, if you can Google random number from 1 to 10.
I would like to pick a number, please.
Oh, yes, ooh, please.
I would like to pick my lucky and favorite number, number 3.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, wait, I'll do it. Let me open my...
Wait, no, Tom, that was a different piece of paper to the first piece of paper you used.
It was. I prepared.
Yeah, they're not all wrapped the same.
How many pieces of paper do you have down there?
Tom, stop opening my gift.
God.
I'm going to open it. Ready?
Do it.
Wow, that's lame.
You're nailing it, Ella.
Right.
That was really badly wrapped, whoever did that. And I think I know who it is, because number three's fact. This fact is pumpkin toadlets are so small they've lost the ability to balance.
It's me!
What? Wait, what is that? What?
Yeah, I don't get it.
So, we've talked about pumpkin toadlets before on the podcast. Uh-huh. They are a species of toadlet. They are one of the smallest vertebrates that exists at the moment. They are the bright orange ones, hence the name, and they are small enough to fit on like a thumbnail. They're teeny tiny.
Wow. Hey, so cute.
They also fluoresce under UV light, which is really, really cool. And yeah, they're tiny. And being tiny is obviously advantageous for them. Mm-hmm. Being small is good. It makes you harder to find, generally, for predators.
Mm-mm. It's a shame they're bright orange then, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. When they find them, they're like, ooh, warning, danger, pumpkin toad look not tasty, won't eat
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But a disadvantage of being so small is that they have terrible balance when they try to hop.
Oh.
But why? What makes them worse than other frogs?
So, it's really cool. So, first off, I will describe what it is like to hop for a pumpkin toadlet. When they hop, they do little cartwheels in the air. They, like, really flounce around. They will often land on their back or on their side because they just can't
so
hop
stupid.
Normally. They are so stupid. It's so great.
You know what I'm wondering, Ella, is... Because we were just talking about how they sort of like evolved to be tiny and bright orange. I can totally imagine them, in evolving so small, lose the ability to like hop stably, maybe. And so it's sort of like an accident. It's like a cost benefit of being so small. But yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Totally.
Oh my God.
Totally.
So, we've established that pumpkin toadlets can't jump well and that they fall over a lot when they try to. The question is, why? So I guess the place that I want to start this off at is, how much do you two know about human balance and our ability to balance?
Ooh!
Something to do with your vestibular system?
Yeah. Do either of you know much about how it works?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought if we just said the magic word, we would be able to get away with it.
It's like
vestibular system.
It's like it's in your inner ear, and it's like the movement of fluids.
Totally.
We have these calcium sulfate crystals in our ears called canaliths.
Wow.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, guys.
I know, I'm just amazed you remember the word offhand.
I don't know like all of the details though, that I just remember that from the
Space Babies.
So, absolutely right. The vestibular system is one of the things that helps us with our balance, and it's relevant to the toad conversation. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So the vestibular system is, again, in our inner ear. It tells us a lot about our motion, our head positioning, orientation, etc.
Ooh, head positioning is really interesting. Because our body is... Sorry.
Yeah, just, go on.
I hadn't considered that, like... And especially for, like, animals with, like, longer necks, I'm sure. That's, like, the difference between the body and the head is a really... Yeah.
I bet animals like chickens, you know how like you can put a camera on a chicken's head and it stabilizes it? I bet they have really, really good vestibular systems.
Yeah, totally.
I had never considered, why is it not in your heart or anything like that, right? Like I guess it's where the sensing organs are.
Well, yeah, totally. Because like we use our eyesight to tell us a lot of this information as well.
Right, yes. So it's sort of paired with, so interesting.
Yeah, totally. So it consists of like two main things. There's the vestibular labyrinth and the cochlea as well. The vestibular labyrinth is what I'm going to talk about today.
What a great phrase.
It's so good, isn't it?
Enter the vestibular labyrinth.
So the vestibular labyrinth is kind of exactly how it sounds. It's in your inner ear. It's a bunch of little tubes. I say a bunch. It's three tubes in humans.
Wow, that's not a bunch. Don't lie to the people.
I'm so sorry.
I was picturing like there to be like a little minotaur in there also.
These little tubes are like a semicircular shape and they are filled with a fluid called endolymph, which is what Ella was talking about. This is a sort of simplified version of it, but it's what you need to know to understand the toad thing. So when we move our heads, the endolymph also moves inside those tubes, basically, and it interacts with hair cells. Mm-hmm, so these hair cells are in a specific place in the vestibular system. When we move around, the liquid in there sloshes around and it like pushes over these hair cells, basically. It interacts with the hair cells. When it interacts with the hair cells, that sends a signal to your brain to tell you information about what's going on with your head, basically. So if you go to the side or if you lean forwards or those sorts of things, if you're rocking backwards and forwards, the liquid in there is sloshing around, interacting with those hairs and going like, oh, we're moving this way. And that is going to get sent to
I'm imagining
brain.
Like having a cup of water on like a boat, right?
Yeah.
And like you can see it moving around and that's how you sort of know which way is down.
Yeah, totally. It's that sort of concept. It's really, really simple when you think about it. It's really cool. So humans have this. That's how humans figure out their balance. Pumpkin toadlets also have a vestibular system.
Right.
But obviously humans are quite large.
Right.
So we've got quite a good sized vestibular system. Other animals also have a vestibular system, I think.
I think most mammals have a vestibular system.
Most mammals do have vestibular systems. And pumpkin toadlets also have a vestibular system. But because pumpkin toadlets are so teeny tiny, their vestibular system is also equally teeny tiny.
Aww.
Researchers looked at, I believe it was something like 147 different species of amphibian, of species of toad, and the pumpkin toadlet had the smallest vestibular system out of all of them. We believe it might have the smallest vestibular system out of any vertebrate that we're aware of so far.
Oh my God.
It's tiny. It is so tiny.
Are there smaller animals that have bigger vestibular systems? Is this the idea? Because there are other vertebrates, right, that will have, that'll be smaller? I don't know. What's the smallest vertebrate?
Well, so a pumpkin toadlet is one of the smallest vertebrates that exists, to be honest.
Right,
so it's not surprising that it has a tiny vestibular system.
So it's a scale thing then?
Yeah, sure.
Totally, yeah.
But it's interesting because, you know, from like a physics perspective, I'm imagining like, if you're on a big boat and you have like a bathtub full of water, right? It is able to like steady itself and you can measure it easier. But if you have like a thimble full of water on a ship, like that's basically nothing, right? Because you can't like the scales of everything. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And the smaller that those little vestibular labyrinths get, the more difficult it is for the liquid in there to slosh around in the way that it needs to.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's the issue that the pumpkin toadlet has.
It's like fluid dynamics. That's so interesting.
It's exactly that.
Curve.
So yeah, so essentially that's the issue that pumpkin toadlets have, is that their vestibular system is so teeny tiny that the liquid in there just can't move around the way that it should move around. And therefore, when it jumps, it sends off a bunch of signals that are just not correct for where it's trying to go. and it does a little flippy poos instead. It struggles with it.
I think it would be totally fine if they were standing still, but the fact that they also do jump is like, oh boy, you're not. So,
I think it means that they don't jump very often. They only really jump if they are like, if they feel threatened by something.
Right.
So if they feel like the predator might be nearby, or if something hits them or touches them, and that's what they had to do in this study to get them to jump. They had to like,
they had to like spook
prod them to get them to go. It's such a cute paper. We'll put it in the show notes. There's a little video of pumpkin toadlets trying to jump as well, which is hilarious. But yeah, so that's my little fact. You might be wondering, how do insects balance? Because obviously insects are smaller than pumpkin toadlets.
Do they not have a vestibular system?
They do not have a vestibular system. They have a few different ones.
Do they use like a different mechanism?
Yeah, totally. So I'm not going to talk about it in too much detail. So some insects have something called a Johnston's organ, which is in their antenna. This is especially for flying insects. And that helps them with detecting motion. And a lot of insects also use the sun to help them orient themselves.
Oh,
right.
Clever.
So that's really, really interesting. So yeah, that's it.
Cute. I want a pet pumpkin toadlet.
Me too.
Yeah, that would have been a better gift.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Fuck these facts. Give me a frog.
Actually, Caroline, if you can with your hands mime it, and then I'll do the Foley on my end.
No, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it, Caroline. Don't indulge him.
So,
yeah.
The gift that I have pulled out is, it's a guest fact.
Woo!
From Astrid. Oh my goodness. It's from Odd Pride, aka Astrid Lundberg, who is an amazing creator. Oh my god.
Hi guys, it's Astrid from Odd Pride on TikTok, and one of my favorite fun facts of all time is that the first flight of the Wright Flyer traveled a distance of 120 feet, which is significantly less than the 210-foot wingspan of a Boeing 747.
Wow.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Wow.
I think I might be, like, having a bit of a fan moment right now. I'm not gonna lie to you. That's so cool.
They were very excited to do this, which made me very happy. But also that, I can't get over that visualization of, like, imagining them on one end of the wing and then, like, barely making it to the middle.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
What a fact. What a fact.
I should also say, I didn't realize this, but this is an extremely timely fun fact, because I wanted to look this up. 2 days from now, December 17th, is the day the Wright brothers made their first flight.
Oh, no, it's so cool.
And that was in 1903, and I believe, let me just double check, the Boeing 747 was first around in 1968.
Wow.
So, like, someone born in 1903 could ride a Boeing 747, which is
that's a horrifying thought. Oh my god.
I think it's I will say, of the like time bendy fun facts, this one is the most like wow. I will also do a quick shout out, which is that Astrid mentioned that they're on a mission to make Wright Flyer Day a sort of a celebration of invention and collaboration. So I would say go check them out. There are bound to be plenty of more facts like that.
Yay!
Yay! Thank you, Astrid!
I'm Jordan Cruciola, the host of Feeling Seen, where we talk about the movie characters that make us feel seen.
And I'm the show's producer, Marissa. Jordan, you've interviewed so many directors, actors, writers, film critics, and I like to play this little game where I take a sip of coffee every time someone says, "That's such a great question."
"That's such a fabulous question."
Or they tell you how smart you are.
"I think that you are rather brilliant."
And of course, the big one is,
When they cry unexpectedly.
Yes, yes.
Jordan, I don't want to cry on your podcast.
I wasn't expecting to cry.
I mean, it makes me kind of want to cry.
Feeling Seen comes out every Thursday on MaximumFun.org. Listen already. What are you waiting for?
Jordan, that's such a great question.
Is it me?
It you.
In the UK, it is illegal to handle a salmon in suspicious circumstances.
I really thought this was going to be mine. Sorry, say that again.
In the UK, it is illegal to handle a salmon in suspicious circumstances. Okay.
Ella, you also look confused by this. And I actually thought that would be a fact that you knew.
It sounds like so...
Oh, hold on. Sorry.
All right.
or maybe that was in a box, so I didn't have to unwrap it.
There's like a bunch of really antiquated laws that are still like written into British law and American law. So like I know there's one in one of the states in the US, I don't know which one, you're not allowed to have like an ice cream cone in your back pocket, like it's legal. And there's like a law somewhere where we used to live, which is like you could legally kill someone on the green of a cathedral with a crossbow.
I just gotta say, these always raise the question where it's like, who was that cathedral crossbow person?
Right. Yeah.
Because it's not like someone, or maybe it's one of those things where like they're writing up the laws and then someone in the back is like, yeah, oh, definitely. And then healthcare, and then it should be legal to do a crossbow.
Yeah.
So, like, huh? What? No, I'm just saying, it just makes sense. It makes sense.
Okay, Caroline, hit us.
What is the origin? What could possibly have caused, and what is suspicious circumstances?
Well, that's such a good question. So I'm going to talk about salmon at the end, because I want to share some silly little UK laws, which are still technically laws, which I just think are ridiculous. There's not too many.
I love
this
these.
Is a short topic. Ella, do you know any off the top of your head for British law?
It's illegal to call football soccer. Just the basics.
Punishable by death, as it should be.
Duh. Yeah.
There needs to be a chip shop within 1 mile of every residence.
So the first
one. It's called a chippy,
one,
Tom.
Yeah, God, Tom.
I thought I was being good by saying chip.
you were so
you get
close.
Points. But you get points on that.
You're learning. You're getting there. So my first little one is, you're not technically allowed to be drunk in a pub.
What?
Excuse me?
Okay, no, that doesn't make sense.
This is as per the Licensing Act of 1872.
That's really
that's
late.
That's very recent. That's not the 1700s, right? Gin stuff. That's
so this what? Act prohibits you from being drunk in any public place. This includes pubs. So that's the general gist of it. And you could face a £200 fine if you are if you are found to be drunk.
If you're found
pub.
To be, oh come on.
So to clarify, this law is not often enforced.
What do you mean often? It shouldn't be enforced at all.
This law would be used if the police are having an issue with somebody and they are looking for a reason to arrest them, basically. So if somebody is potentially going to be a problematic person whilst they are drunk, the police can come in and use this act to arrest them.
That's
basically.
Awful. That's wild. Awful.
Yeah,
even
that's
if
no
even
good.
If the person needs to be controlled, that is a terrible, terrible law. A
terrible tactic, right? Yeah. My next one is, you're not allowed to fly a kite in public.
In the privacy of your own home is where that should be. Between you and God.
So this is from the Metropolitan Police Act of 1893.
Still so recent. Just the 1890s, they were really like, we can write anything.
We're
no one
gonna
will find
ruin
out.
Everybody's fun time. You're not allowed to get drunk. You're not allowed to fly kites. Or what
I
can
thought
I say?
A lot of these. I thought a lot of these would be like holdovers from like, you know, Oliver Cromwell.
Yeah,
he was obviously massively puritanical and banned everything. So I thought a lot of them would be from then.
This is actually one of the things on Martin Luther's list that he hammered on everyone's door. Right?
So the reason for this one is, in theory, this act was designed to prevent like disorderly behavior in public. However, it went a little bit extreme. This law also banned sledding. When it gets snowy, you're not allowed to go sledding or tobogganing. You're not allowed to carry a plank of wood in public,
what?
Unless you're putting it into a vehicle.
I mean, yeah, Just think of the children.
Yeah, and there was a committee, Mothers Against Planks of Wood in public.
This also bans knock and run pranks. So knocking on somebody's door and running away. It's all covered under this law.
In the US, we call that a ding-dong ditch.
I think I remember being told that at some point when I was a kid to scare me, to stop me from doing it, but it turns out it was true.
Yeah, yeah, it actually is. Again, these laws are not enforced anymore, but they could use it to prosecute someone.
The two things I love about this is it does sort of imply that like kites were a huge craze in the 1890s.
Yeah,
like, every other kid was like, "Woo! You can't stop me, coppers." And then the other thing is I would love to see the kite version of Footloose, where this town is pure tyrannical town. It's like
that's so dumb.
But I gotta, and then does like a routine with the kite, and the pastor's like, "Wow, he is right. We shouldn't be able to fly kite."
I would watch that film.
So stupid.
My next one, I assume we're all aware that whoever is the monarch at the time owns all of the swans in England. Are we all aware of, let's get that as a base layer, Tom?
I very recently learned that we can't let it go passing without the fact that that's wild.
It gets a little bit, there's more. The monarch can also claim any beached whale in the UK.
Claim?
Yep, they can claim them. This is according to the prerogative regis of the King's Prerogative in 1322.
Right. Yep. Okay, of course. 1322. That makes a bit more sense to me.
Yeah, there we go.
Sure. I'm just thinking back to the things that the British stole, where it's like, I'm just imagining the Queen getting received this, like, prized treasure from another country she doesn't understand and being like, just toss it in the museum. And then she's like, but that beached whale! Ooh, give me that! That's what I want for Christmas!
So,
these days,
people don't offer these specimens to the monarch very often, but people do try to offer things like beached whales to the monarch.
Yeah, naturally.
The last time this happened, this law also applies to sturgeons. So, the last time that
goes without saying.
Essentially, Queen Elizabeth II was offered a sturgeon, and she kindly rejected it so that it could be donated to the Natural History Museum instead.
Oh, how kind of her.
How lovely of her, right?
It is her God-given right to receive that sturgeon.
Like, somebody would have had to have picked up the sturgeon and, like, have it in the boot of their car or something to go and take it, and then, like, package it up and offer it to the Queen. I love that image in my head, basically.
Yeah, I hope it happened like that. I hope someone dumped it on the steps of Buckingham Palace.
And now, talking about fish, let's get back to the salmon thing. So,
I completely forgot.
So, to say it again, it is illegal to suspiciously handle a salmon here in the UK.
Which, suspiciously holding a salmon sounds like a Monty Python sketch. It's like the, the Ministry of Funny Walks.
So this is under Section 32 of the Salmon Act.
32 of the Salmon Act, yeah.
1986.
Sorry,
19,
say that again.
Oh, wait!
1986. No. This is Section 32 of the Salmon Act.
Why? What was someone doing?
So, this is so interesting to me. The idea of this law is basically, at the time, there was a lot of salmon being illegally hunted and then sold.
Right.
Okay.
So,
right,
initially,
okay.
The law was that it was illegal to be in possession of one of these illegally obtained salmons, right?
Yeah.
However, they found that this was unfairly penalizing people who had accidentally bought the salmon to consume.
Okay, that kind of makes sense.
Okay.
So instead, the wording of the law was to target people who were suspiciously handling salmon to sell them in public.
Right.
Caroline, you could not have offered me, I would not have bet any amount of money that by the end of this I would actually understand that this law actually kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think it, of all of them by far, actually kind of makes sense.
The suspicious salmon one, I'm totally on board with. Yeah, because like,
that
if you bought a salmon and it's been illegally obtained in some way, you're not going to be walking around suspiciously, are you?
I just kind of hope that this law has been like used on someone's purchased a salmon and then they've done, you know, they're a bit of a weird person and they're doing something suspicious with the salmon.
Yeah, they're like, hey, can I get two tickets to the movie? One ticket to the movie, please. Just one, actually. I don't have a salmon.
I just love the idea that would have been used on someone who wasn't selling salmon, who would just had salmon.
Who had, like, just, I don't know, pickpocketed somebody to buy the salmon and then was carrying their salmon suspiciously because they were...
It makes perfect sense in the same way that, like, you would want this for, like, snakes or alligators, like, people who, like, trade those as, like, pets and stuff like that. It makes perfect sense where it's, you know what? They just gotta work on the word suspicious because it makes it seem...
When you say it out loud initially, you're like... What the fuck are you talking about? It takes some explaining.
Yeah, it's a person in a trench coat and they open it and there's salmon inside.
So yeah, that's the end of my fun UK laws. There are more.
That's one.
Maybe y'all should shout on Discord your favorite silly law in your country. You can find the link at letslearneverythingpod.com. Shameless plug right there.
Wow,
you're really seamless with these plugs these days.
Synergy,
thank
man.
You.
It's like you work for Let's Learn Everything. It's really
over a year of practice now, baby.
Is it me? Okay, I'm gonna look who it is. This is from our good friend of the pod, Ashlyn Campbell.
Oh!
Also known as Trash Bandicoot.
Oh my goodness.
Can I open the fact before you play it?
Oh, yes, of course.
Why? Why is the fact in a bottle, Ella?
I don't know. Ask Ash. They put it there.
I should ask the person who wrapped it. You're so right.
Hey, everyone, it's Ash. My fun fact is that bees can blow bubbles. When bees collect nectar, they ingest the watery, sugary substance into their crop, which is a special chamber in the foregut used to store food for transport back to the nest.
I want to take a quick pause because I did look this up. And Ash is talking about the crop, which is like this like little sack that comes before the stomach.
Right.
And it's for storing and regurgitating honey. But it's also sometimes known as the honey stomach.
Aww.
And I will say, for any entomologists out there, I haven't seen anyone use the phrase honey tummy, and I think that's
a crime.
Clearly lacking, because that's exactly what it is. It's their little honey tummy. I just had to mention that. Anyway, continuing on.
And small solitary bees need to maximize the nutrients they're bringing back to the nest because their offspring will hatch alone in a sealed chamber or burrow, and they need enough food to survive until they become an adult. But bees only have so much room in their crop, so some bees will regurgitate nectar from their crop and hold it in a tiny little bubble outside their mouth, letting excess water evaporate away before they swallow it again. This is thought to serve the dual purpose of creating a more concentrated substance and therefore a richer source of nutrients, as well as freeing up space in the crop to allow them to gather more food without having to return to the nest so soon. The behavior is called bubbling, and it's not exclusive to females. Males that don't take care of offspring do it as well, because it lets them make the most of foraging opportunities. All this means that if you look carefully at a flowering plant, you might be lucky enough to see a small solitary bee sitting still blowing bubbles. Happy holidays, everyone.
Oh my god! I want to see that so badly.
Oh my god!
Caroline's mouth was agape the whole fact.
That was so good.
Ash really coming in with the facts that we obviously will love. Bee facts, always.
Targeted
bee facts.
I love that so much because it starts off like, oh, a bee is blowing bubbles. I wonder why. And it's like, you have to pull out like anatomy chart and like a physics fluid diagram of like how it evaporates and concentrates the liquid. And it's just, are you looking it up, Caroline?
Oh, they're so cute. It's just a little bit. And they just have like a little bubble and then all of their hands and stuff around it. Ah, it's so cute. I'm gonna cry. Honestly, they're so cute.
Christmas is an emotional time of year.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ashlyn.
Thank you, Ashlyn.
Yeah, thank you so much. All right. Whose turn is it next?
You? No, Caroline.
Hi. It me.
Oh.
What's this?
There are no, in all caps, no American flags on Mars. Who could this be from, Tom? who could that be?
This is from me. I'm leading off with that to make you all happy, but obviously there's a bit more to that because this is the sequel to How Many Objects Are on the Moon from episode 13. It's just obviously a much smaller number, and so I thought this would be a perfect place to fit it in.
Wait, before you say this, can I just say, if we ever write like a Let's Everything book, this would be like a great title for it. Like, there are no American flags on Mars. It's just like a really great...
Oh, yeah!
Or like, that would be the sequel, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It does sort of encapsulate our feelings about imperialism and also science at the same time. So... do y'all happen to remember how many human placed objects are on the moon? I don't blame you if you don't know. I forgot. I had to look it up.
Oh, fuck.
Not totally. It was like hundreds. High. Because of all the
It was hundreds.
Equipment.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And some of them were bombs.
Yep. Some were grenades. So if you want to know the answer, listen to episode 13. We'll wait.
Oh,
cheeky.
Beautiful plug there,
Tom. Come back in a little bit. Just give them a second. It's a pretty long episode. No. As of 2019, the number was 809 discrete objects, probably more by this point.
Can you please bleep out? Because they should go back and listen to the episode. You've just ruined it for someone.
You don't get facts for free.
No. So maybe someone's not listening to them in order and you've just spoiled it.
All right. Spoiler alert.
Well, you can't say the spoiler alert after you've said the fact.
Okay, we've got to start this in. All again.
Start over. 'Twas the night week before the holidays. So 809 human objects on the moon. Can you guess how many are on Mars? And I'm curious why you think that. Like, what makes the number different?
It for me, the number is different because it's further away.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I hope that there are less grenades on Mars. Just putting that out there.
That's our campaign promise.
I hope there are
fewer grenades on Mars.
Yeah,
oh, never mind. It's more grenades on Mars by 2025.
I think there's going to be hundreds there still.
I still think it's going to be like 500. Yeah.
Yeah. Materials, objects. Does the Mars rover drop a lot of stuff? Nuts and bolts.
So there are obviously a million reasons why landing on Mars is harder than landing on the moon, even more so than distance. But like, to Caroline's point, Mars is 170 times farther from us than the moon. And of course, because of the way it moves around the sun, sometimes it's even farther than that. So at its closest, it's 170 times farther than us.
Oh, wow.
Another thing to consider is that the gravity is twice as much as on the moon, which makes landing difficult. And I found a really great quote from NASA engineer Rob Manning in the Smithsonian Magazine that explains like why it's so difficult. He says, quote, "Mars is neither like the moon nor Earth, but is annoyingly in between. It has too much atmosphere to land as we do on the moon and not enough to land as we do on Earth." And so he goes on, "We have to combine all of the tricks we use to land on Earth, heat shields, parachutes, with the techniques we use to land on the moon. Retro rockets, airbags, among many others."
So what you're saying is that there's less things there because it's harder to land. But all I'm hearing is we're using a ton of stuff to land on Mars, though. So surely there's still quite a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's an interesting. You're getting into exactly why the number is both small and then going to be bigger. So, but you know, with all of these things combined, the issues of distance, difficulty, landing, all these things, unlike the moon missions, which could have things like people and food and all sorts of extra junk on them, the Mars missions don't have that same luxury because they are much harder to do and they have to be a lot more efficient and they're a lot riskier. And so almost every object on the moon falls under the category of a rover or a lander, like a single object that you can drop and has all the gadgets and gizmos like on it.
Okay.
As opposed to having astronauts walk over and set up a bespoke grenade launcher on the moon. So by my count, And this, I will say, this number is both a lot harder for NASA to track it, and it's also not as available as like the moon numbers. But by my count, there are around 22 scientific objects, including landers that, you know, just meant to land, rovers, and also the Ingenuity helicopter. But that is also definitely an underestimate. 22, because first of all, it's a lot harder to like keep track of things that are so far away. But in some ways, even though we aren't dealing with like bags of human waste on Mars, trash is in some ways a bigger issue than it is on the moon, because it's harder to land there. So to Ella's point, there are like parachutes and like all these disposed of apparatuses for these landers and rovers. There have also been 17 orbiters on Mars that have sprinkled just like unknown amounts of debris on the planet as they eventually come down on it. This is perhaps most an issue when it comes to things like contamination. Like, it would suck if the first Martian sample we're able to send back to Earth has just like junk in it that we left that ruins the sample. You know, and I will say it's
we've never brought anything back from Mars.
No, we haven't.
I don't know why I thought we had. Huh.
Yeah.
That's weird to me.
Tremendously difficult. Yeah. But that does put that into perspective how difficult the mission is. We can't get anything back from Mars. But there are some beautiful things left on Mars. And this is another benefit, is because, again, it's so difficult to get there, those sort of sentimental things are extremely condensed instead of being littered around. So, for example, there are the names of over 10 million people etched into 3 fingernail-sized chips, and they are bolted onto the Perseverance rover.
No, that's nice.
So that's sort of, you know, it's not like the Perseverance rover had like a whole mechanism for like ejecting this chip or like planting it down. It's sort of like on the rover. And, you know, I will say some of the rovers have the American flag emblazoned on them, but it's not a flag planted on the planet. Yeah. They didn't make a robotic arm specifically for planting the flag.
Imagine. But I don't know, I think that kind of negates it a little bit. There are American flags on Mars.
Images of, but, and well, I will say, you know, if we had landed on Mars maybe like 30 years earlier into the Cold War, they might have made an arm that plants a flag.
Yeah.
But yeah, so NASA had a program to submit your name to be etched. And so, and they've actually done it a handful of times before. The Phoenix lander also had a, quote, mini DVD from the Planetary Society that contains a message to future Martian explorers, science fiction stories, and art inspired by the Red Planet, and the names of more than a quarter million Earthlings.
Wow. Oh, okay. Next time that they do that, could someone let me know in the Discord so that I can get my name on there?
Yeah, and get the Discord link in there onto Mars. Yeah, yeah. I will say, I know that things like that are like entirely symbolic and just like just for us. But a mini DVD doesn't seem the most future-proof. Like, I know no one's going to actually listen to the Golden Record, but at least something that is a little more future-proof than a format that doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, but, like, if we'd sent the, like you were saying, if we'd sent the Mars rover earlier, would we have sent a floppy disk thinking that was the height of, you know?
Oh, boy. Ooh, yeah.
It's always going to be go out of use, right?
Well, so, and that's what's interesting about the golden records that are on the Voyager probe, because, and we talked about this with like analog recording, is that technically you could convert a record to sound, because it's the physical sound wave, but a DVD is digital. And
okay.
So you would need to have the exact codec to which is impossible. And again, I know that it's impossible that they find it anyway, so it's kind of nil, but I just think that's a little silly. And I will say, there are a ton of Easter eggs I'm sure I'm missing, because all of them are basically like really tiny, and you should go to the Discord and let us know any that I missed.
Oh,
that you
my
like.
Goodness.
How many Discord mentions are we going to get in on this?
But I will say, my favorite little Easter egg by far is that on the Ingenuity helicopter, which is the first aerial robot on Mars, there is a tiny piece of fabric from, can you guess?
Elon Musk.
A mummy.
It's a tiny piece of fabric from the Wright brothers' first flyer.
Oh, wow.
No way.
That is good. That is good.
Aww.
As NASA said, quote, while Ingenuity will attempt the first powered controlled flight on another planet, the first powered controlled flight on Earth took place December 17th, 1903, on the windswept dunes of Kill Devil Hill near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. I think that's really sweet.
That's real neat.
That is, yeah. That is.
That's all our junk on Mars.
Yay! Let's put more there.
Woo! We're going to.
Who's next? Oh, is it me?
Oh my god.
Oh, it's a guest fact. Another one.
Wow.
And this is from our friend, paleontologist Evelyn Vollmer.
Evelyn!
Yay! Evelyn.
Oh my goodness!
I didn't get to meet Evelyn, so this is nice.
Hey, my name is Evelyn Vollmer, and my favorite fun science-y fact is that the iPhone is closer in geological age to Tyrannosaurus Rex than Tyrannosaurus Rex is to Stegosaurus, and by millions of years.
I feel like I heard this fact before. It's so good. It's so good.
Carolina's in complete shock.
I'm so unhappy.
And did you look up the distance between them, Tom?
Oh, yeah. I pulled up the numbers, yeah. Because I was so curious.
I'm sorry. What?
Caroline's still processing. We'll give them a few minutes. We'll give the listeners also a few minutes to fully digest this. Ella, do you know, while Caroline is do you know what year the iPhone was released? I know on like timescales it doesn't it's not gonna matter at all.
2007?
You got it, exactly. 2007, yeah. Caroline, do you know what year Apple released the Tyrannosaurus Rex?
You're funny, Tom.
Thanks, guys.
I have no clue what year.
Yeah.
Or how long ago.
100 million years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's roughly. So it's...
wow, Ella.
The T-Rex was on Earth between 66 to 68 million years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is also how I learned about the unit MA, or Mega Annus, which is 1 million years. So if you see like 66 MA.
Yeah.
And so the time period the T-Rex was around was the late Cretaceous, which is also when Triceratops were around, just to give you like a mental image about what it was like. And so can you guess when the Stegosaurus were living on Earth?
500 million years ago.
I was going to say 300.
So it's 145 to 155 million years ago.
Okay.
And that is the late Jurassic period. And this is when brachiosaurs and apatosaurs were around, as well as allosaurs, which are sort of like a smaller tyrannosaurus. But yeah, still farther from the T-Rex than the iPhone is. How does that make y'all feel?
It reminds me of, I don't know how to describe it other than like those pie charts you see. And it's got like the little wedge, the teeny tiny little wedge is how long like humans have existed. And then the rest of it is, it reminds me of that.
I feel like, and maybe this is like impossible. I really just want to like, maybe we'll do this one day, get like the whole time scale of like all the big things that happen.
Yeah.
So I have that in my bones instead of being surprised every time.
I guess what really shocks me about this fact is the human aspect of it. Like how the dinosaurs, something that I know they're not as similar as we think they are, but something that we perceive as very similar to each other, living over hundreds of millions of years, whereas humans have like changed so much within the last maybe 2 million years.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in such a small, short space of time. Like, I think that's quite crazy to me.
Definitely.
The dinosaurs span such huge, like history of the planet.
I will say, I totally understand why people want to mash them up together because like amazing design wise.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be like if you found out that like Iron Man and Spider-Man were separated by millions of years and you were like, come on, can we just like bend the rules a little bit to have
together.
Them
together? Yeah.
But I will say, I think, and I hope more movies do this, I feel like it's definitely possible to like have your cake and eat it too with this. Like you can make the fact that they were so far apart an interesting plot point, you know what I mean? Like if you can imagine like a Jurassic Park where like a T-Rex sees a Stegosaurus and is like, they're both just like, what even are you?
Yeah.
Like I was not evolved to eat you and now you're just here. I think that there's potential for this to be more entertaining as opposed to it like ruining anything.
You know what, if we design Jurassic Park, what we can have the different eras and the dinosaurs can be in their different spaces. How about
yes!
that?
Yes. Love
because
that.
nothing ever goes wrong on Jurassic Park. No.
Yeah, are you pitching me a Jurassic Park right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, yeah.
I see nothing wrong with this plan.
No, it's foolproof. We'll get it right.
Yeah. I feel like this fact also just solidifies to me how little I know about the history of the planet that we live on. And it makes me want to know it more.
Mm-hmm.
Especially dinosaurs. when I was looking this up just to like get the numbers, I looked up like when T-Rex was around and then when Stegosaur was around, and I was like, oh wait, Evelyn's wrong, like the numbers are very similar. And then I realized I mixed up Stegosaurs and Triceratops. just entirely mixed them up. I was like, I'm really glad we have Evelyn to call on if we ever need some dino knowledge, because it's so easy to just like make a tiny mistake like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, thanks so much, Evelyn.
Thanks, Evelyn.
All
okay.
Right.
Is it me?
Yeah.
And it's a guest fact, and this is...
Who's it from?
It's Sabrina Cruz.
No way!
Oh, I'm so glad you got Sabrina.
Oh my goodness.
Hi, I'm Sabrina. I make videos at Answer in Progress, and I want to tell you about the Brussels sprout renaissance. I don't know if you remember this. I remember this, and I'm 24, so you might remember this. But Brussels sprouts were kind of like the go-to stereotypical nasty food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're stinky, they can be tough to cook well, and they are bitter. Or at least, they were. You see, according to this 2019 NPR report, in the 90s, this Dutch scientist, Hans van Doorn, identified the chemical that causes the bitterness in Brussels sprouts. Seed companies then started crossbreeding varieties that had low levels of that chemical, resulting in Brussels sprouts that genuinely tasted better. These got adopted by celebrity chefs and recipe designers who increased the demand dramatically. Some parts of the industry have grown tenfold, according to vegetablegrowersnews.com.
Oh my god.
A very real website that is exactly what you expect. So happy holidays and eat your vegetables. They taste good now.
Oh my god, Sabrina, that's
wow.
Okay, I cannot express to you how much I love that fact. That's like the kind of fact when I go and have all the Christmas dinners I'm gonna have over the next couple of weeks, I'm gonna be sat there like, oh hey guys, do you know that actually Brussels sprouts have been bred specifically to make them? I'm literally gonna say that about 20 times over the next 2 weeks to people. And this is such an interesting fact because it really plays into like the last 100 years, last century of or more of us breeding plants to make specific vegetables that people don't even realize are bred like made specifically by humans. Like it's not broccoli, is it? It might be
corn.
Literally everything.
any fucking citrus is because we've bred them together.
I will say, like, what makes this so amazing to me is the fact that it happened so recently.
Right?
Yeah. Because like this is like literally what Gregor Mendel was doing with like pea pods. And now it took until the 90s for this specifically.
It kind of makes sense. It's like, what was the demand for like, they're probably... I mean,
that's a good point.
Scientist made the demand, but it took someone being like, I should find out what this is. And that was, I guess it is surprising that it took so long for them to... No, I guess not, because the tools we have to isolate chemical compounds like that are reasonably recent. Mm. Like, Mendel couldn't have done that in his time.
Sure.
Yeah, totally.
And I will say, for me, the most interesting part is the cultural and, like, culinary opinion shift, because it's not like when this happened in 1990, like, the United Nations was like, Brussels sprouts are good now, right? Like, it had to start from these like vegetablegrowersnews.coms, and then like some chefs had to try it, and then that had to spread, and then like people had to then try these recipes themselves.
I wondered though, because
it was the 90s, I believe, 1990s.
Okay, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that like that is I don't doubt that that's like a huge part of it, but some people were just eating Brussels sprouts anyway, so do you think it just like people just carried on eating them, and then they were like, one day they just sat down and they were like, oh, this is different.
Wait a second.
It's all right, aren't they? Ooh.
Fool me 100 times.
People
shame
were
on
eating
me.
Them before, so I'm like, did someone sit down and then one day go, this is horrible now, what have they done?
somebody being like, kids these days don't know how awful Brussels sprouts used to be.
I read the NPR article that she mentions, and they do talk a lot about, like, a lot of chefs were talking about, like, the first time that they realized that they could, like, use it. Like, they mentioned, like, they went to, like, a restaurant by David Chang, and, like, he was doing it, and then they were like, oh, wait, maybe I can do something like this. So there is sort of, like, this, like...
Oh, no, I'm sure that, like, to get the mainstream, it had to start somewhere
but
like that.
But then, to your point, there are those... They're the old fans. They're like, I like Brussels sprouts before they were good.
Yeah, I wonder. Wow, what a good fact.
That is a great
Sabrina.
Fact.
Thanks, Sabrina.
Thanks, Sabrina.
Hal Lublin here with breaking news on a revolutionary form of entertainment, professional wrestling. For more, we go to our correspondent, Danielle Radford.
Professional wrestling is the craze that's sweeping the nation, featuring fisticuffs and colorful costumes.
But who can help us make sense of this world of body slams? Lindsay Kelk has the answer.
Sources tell us of an amazing podcast called Tights and Fights, filled with discussions of the absurdity of professional wrestling, plus all the sincerity and hilarity that you could shake a stick at.
Listen to the Tights and Fights podcast every week.
Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
And your old-timey radio.
All right. Caroline's turn.
Oh, it's my turn. Oh, God, it's such a long one. Okay, hang on. Okay. TV pickup is the term to describe the uniquely British phenomenon where an advertising break during a TV event with a large national audience, such as Football World Cup, causes a surge in demand on the energy grid. What typically causes this surge? I know the answer to this, I think.
I do know this answer also, because I watch my friends' TikToks.
Oh, no! I was hoping that you wouldn't have seen it.
Shall we all say it together?
You want to tell everyone?
You guys say it.
Kettles.
It's British people making cups of tea.
Yes, TV pickup refers to a surge on the national grid when everyone turns on their kettles to make a cup of tea. But other appliances also apply, like ovens and changes like central heating being turned on as well. Now, here are some examples of the largest TV pickup events recorded. and this is, I've just selected a few of my favourites, and this is from the least usage to the most usage. So, the 29th of April, 2011, this is the wedding of Will and Kate.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah.
The 5th of August, 1985. This is the finale, the season finale of Dallas.
What? Why? Yeah.
It was really popular, apparently. The 5th of April, 2001, an episode of the soap EastEnders, where the viewers found out who shot Phil Mitchell. And this would have been either before or after the show, because EastEnders is on BBC, which doesn't have advertisement breaks. And the 4th of July, the highest on the list out of all of them. 4th of July, 1990. This is England versus West Germany in the FIFA World Cup semi-final penalty shootout. Oh. which England lost.
Why anything other than football? It was just so specific.
Yeah.
I was really expecting, like, you know, like the Berlin Wall falling or something like that. Like, but no, it's no. It was a penalty shootout.
No, we're British. We go for football, unfortunately.
Oh my god.
I know that this fact can be well known depending on who you talk to, but I've always wanted to talk about, like, more about it, but I've never thought it would fit a whole topic, so this is good for me.
Yay! Mm-hmm.
You'll notice that most of these larger events are over 20 years old, and this isn't because the system has changed.
Oh, huh. Yeah, I did not put that together. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was kind of expecting to see one that was recent, but...
Mm-hmm. There was one on that list that that's on Wikipedia. It was from 2020, so it does still happen.
Can I make a guess you're saying it's not due to the power lines changing, right?
No.
Or like being more efficient. Is it just due to the fact that we don't watch TV anymore?
Yeah, so it's a mix of, especially in the UK, this is an issue in like the 80s because we had very few TV channels. Most people only had access to like 5 TV channels. So
a
wider range of TV channels being available is one of the things. And now, even more recently, more people using streaming services means that you just don't have advertisement breaks in the same way anymore. But it does still happen, particularly during like football events or things like the Queen's speech.
Yeah.
Mm,
yeah.
Mm, mm.
So why this happens? Why does this matter? All British mains plug sockets output 230 volts of electricity at a frequency of 50 hertz. If a sudden increase in the demand isn't met by an increase in supply, it can cause a drop in the frequency output, that 50 hertz, across the grid.
Oh.
Because you can't store energy. It's just continuously put in at the right level, kept at this 49 to 50 hertz range. It's not going to be the end of the world if this happened, but it could cause things like large-scale blackouts.
Yeah, when other power supply using things like medical equipment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the National Grid, which distributes power, has to try and predict which TV events and other general events will be popular to meet demand. They have a dedicated analyst who checks the TV listings.
I was going to say that as a joke.
It's not a joke. They have, at least back in 2013, they had a dedicated analyst who checked the TV listings every day to try and predict spikes. Just what a job that is.
Yeah. They're like just watching TV at home. This is work. Yeah, I need to catch up on Dallas, actually, for my job. I got to see how big of an event this is going to be.
Yeah. Nigel Williams, head of the electricity systems operation at the National Grid in 2013, said in a Guardian article, "People's behavior always surprises me in that it's so predictable. You get exactly the same curve on Christmas Day, year after year after year."
Oh, yeah.
And this is due to people going and turning on ovens at the same time to cook and watching the same TV shows because everyone is at home.
Wow.
Williams also said, "The TV pickup from Deal or No Deal is gobsmackingly high. How sad is that?"
Wow.
I would not have guessed that.
Fascinating, like, data point to consider. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Jeremy Kaplan, energy forecaster manager at the National Grid in 2013, said, "There used to be pickup for the Queen's speech, but not so much now." Well, definitely not anymore, Jeremy, so instead.
Jesus.
So just to end this fact, the National Grid also has to plan for the opposite effect, a mass shutdown of appliances so there isn't too much power being provided and overloading the system. So, for example, on the 6th of September 1997, the funeral of Princess Diana caused a huge drop in electricity usage. Jeremy Kaplan called Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas, the lowest of the low in terms of power usage.
Wow.
There you go.
It's such a combination of like sociology, psychology, and then also this like technical restraint of this National Grid. That's wild. Thank you for this gift. All right. It's my present. Second to last one.
Yep.
Oh, and it's a guest fact.
Ooh.
Hello, everybody. It's Hank Green, and I have a fun fact for you. It's the origin of the word Botox, that stuff that people put in their face so that they have fewer wrinkles. That comes, it's just a compression of the words botulinum and toxin, because it is a toxin produced by Clostridium botulinum, which is a bacteria. And it causes botulism, which is a very dangerous disease because it creates this toxin that in very, very small amounts can relax muscles, but also in more amounts relaxes too many muscles, and you might die of that. But the weird thing is, I haven't got to the part that is extra fascinating to me, which is that botulinum, that actually comes from the word botulus, which was the Greek word, is the Latin word, not Greek, Latin word for sausage. And that, I thought, was because Clostridium botulinum is rod-shaped bacteria, so they kind of look like sausages. But in fact, no. It's because sausages were the first place the disease came from. And so it was called botulism because it was sausageism. So you got sausageism from the sausages, and then we named the bacteria after the disease, and then we named the Botox after the bacteria. Weird.
That's so funny.
That's all. Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays, Hank. Thank you so much.
Caroline is still too stunned to speak.
I'm still processing. Sorry, just putting that out there. Again, fanning out a little bit over here. Yeah, that's really cool.
For those who don't know, Hank Green is some guy we know. He's this small upcoming creator, started making videos on TikTok. We just wanted to give him the LLE bump.
Yeah, just give him a follow because he really needs the support.
We're really doing him a solid with this.
Thank you so much for doing that, Hank.
Yeah, thanks, Hank. But Ella, were you aware of this also?
So I knew that botulinum toxin was the longer version of Botox, and I knew that botulinum toxin started in pork. I didn't know that the word botulus is what he said is the was sausage. I didn't realize that's what it was. That's very good. That's very funny.
That's really cool.
But Botox is a very, maybe one day I'll do a topic on it, because there's lots of interesting things about Botox. Like they use it to treat headaches.
Yeah.
Because of the, for the same reason they use it to treat, in the same way they use it to treat wrinkles, because of the paralyzing effect in that area.
I will say, Ella, I would love if you did a topic on like misused medicine. I don't know if that's the phrase, but I feel like so much of medical history is like, we wanted it to do this.
Yeah, that we started it on this and then it ended up doing something else. Like Viagra, which was a heart medicine. Yeah.
Was it actually?
Yeah.
Oh my, another fun fact.
There's loads like that. That's a good idea.
Yeah. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah. I feel like the turns it took became like a mini episode in terms of there's like the science portion and then the miscellaneous at the end, where it's like, that's the real treat is the sausage. I also gotta say, whoever came up with naming it to Botox wins the award for the best, like, drop the just Facebook rebranding. Like, amazing. Are you kidding me?
It's also very interesting the fact that the rename Botox, like, it doesn't take, it's not that hard to track back its meaning. Like, it's not like it's gonna name something completely different, and the actual name of it is so unappealing that I'm surprised that it was like that sellable. Like, it literally has the word toxin in it.
I don't know how they got away with it. It's like if like we found out that like pneumonia made you taller, it's like, now try Pneumia. All right,
Caroline, you Ella? Can oh, is it me? I thought I just did one.
You got this. The last gift.
I get to unwrap the... Stop opening it, Tom!
It's honestly so rude.
I'm just reaching over, I'm pulling gonna it
open,
apart.
I'll open the final gift. Thank you.
Ooh!
Oh, that's weird. I wonder what's in there.
Jesus Christ.
The final fact is, of course, Tom's fact. And it is... No. No. That's unacceptable. What? Is this a joke?
Huh? What?
The animal with the longest sperm is Drosophila bifurca at 5.8 centimeters. Uncoiled, it is over 20 times the length of its body. That's...
Is it clear that I re-gifted that fun fact? I was really hoping no one would notice. For those who don't know, this is historically Ella's favorite fun fact.
How dare you take that from me?
Well, okay. I guess you wouldn't be interested in this other gift I have over here, which is the animal with the shortest sperm.
Yes!
I guess you wouldn't want that.
Oh, yes! Okay,
all right.
Oh, I can't believe you've done this to me. I'm so excited.
I'm so happy that this is the last fact as well. Like, I don't know how you managed that, Tom.
this is like when my folks used to do this to me with a kid. As a kid, is you like hide a video game inside some clothes, and so you open, it's like, oh, sweater, and then you open inside, it's like Smash Bros. and I thought, Ella, since you already, this felt like gifting you a pepper shaker to match your salt shaker that you already have with
this is wonderful.
Fun fact.
Because I'm going to use this all the time alongside my sperm bank.
It's so good to get a gift and you know your friend will use all the time. So, do either of you know what it is? What animal this is?
I have no idea. Are we talking about length in proportion to its body or just general length?
General length, yeah. And I was also, I got to say, I was amazed because I feel like we all the time like try to answer these superlative questions. And there was a paper, the title of which is The Length of a Short Sperm, that seems to pretty confidently make this statement, which I love.
I'm trying to think about an animal, because like, if it's short because it's got a short tail for swimming, for mobility reasons, then that means that the sperm has to be deposited close by. And now I'm thinking about animal genitals quite a lot.
Okay, happy holidays, everyone.
And...
I think it must not be a mammal for some reason, because I know that like sperm don't ask me how I know this. A sperm size is like reasonably uniform across mammals because, like,
that makes sense. That checks
whales,
out to me.
Whales is smaller than human, but it's like 50 to 57 microns, and humans is like 70 to 90 microns. But it's all in this kind of same range of size, though. So if we're talking small, then I'm gonna have to go. It's like maybe it's like 1 micron small or something like that, or maybe even
nano. Is it a type of bee?
Yeah, it's an insect.
I don't know if this is bug-ist of me to say bees and wasps are similar, but it is a wasp, so.
Wow.
Because bee vibes, you know, it makes me happy. Okay.
So, like I said, this comes from a paper titled The Length of a Short Sperm, and they say, quote, "The spermatozoan of the parasitoid wasp, Cotesia congregata, is an extremely short gamete measuring less than 7 microns or micrometers. It is as yet the shortest flagellated sperm to be identified."
I'm so sorry. Tell me the length again.
7 microns or micrometers.
Nice. Okay. Nice. What a horrible reaction.
So for scale's sake, a micron is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, which makes it, in comparison to the Drosophila sperm, 8,000 times smaller. Nice. Even though both of their bodies are almost identical in size. They're both 3 millimeters long.
The fact that they're both insects is very weird. Very weird that's changed in evolution somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it makes perfect sense because of how often they reproduce, and we know how many species,
insects
is like that. So, like, in some ways it makes sense, but it is also
so
wild that, like, they literally, like, you could have both of them sitting on a leaf, and they are just like so different in that way. So it's also so small that the nucleus of the sperm is longer than the flagellum, like the tail, which is
that
wild.
Is crazy.
No way.
Yeah. And so the paper this comes from is a very, very real and like extremely well documented paper. There's like electron microscope images and like cross sections and like explanatory drawings. It's really great, actually. And the paper's mainly focused on, interestingly, not the like sort of reproductive aspects of like embryonic development. It's focused on the development of the sperm itself, spermatogenesis, which is something that I had never like thought very much about, because I feel like we talk so much about like embryonic development, but not so much on like how the egg and the sperm themselves develop, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I did a whole module on this at university.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's just...
I haven't. I did it.
No.
And what makes this more interesting, besides it being a very short sperm, is during the sperm's development, it actually grows twice as long, and then it shortens again to 7 microns. So it starts off small, gets long, and then goes back to short, which is a really interesting sort of like development. And so it's interesting in both like an evolutionary perspective as well as a cellular development perspective, which is cool. They say, quote, "The elongation of both the nucleus and flagellum, followed by a significant reduction, also constitutes a real novelty in biology, which deserves careful investigation. This species could be a suitable model for studying the mechanisms involved in regulation of axoneme length. It could be used as a comparative model for cilia and flagella abnormalities leading to illness, not restricted to the field of reproductive biology."
Nice.
So they're just like, it's a weird cell. Let's take a look and let's see what we can, what we can learn from that, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool.
That's great, Tom. What a great pairing.
Ooh.
Like a good cheese and a wine, but two sperms.
So that's all the, I don't see anything else under the tree. I think we've opened them all. We've all gotten our gifts.
But last year I got 26 presents.
But last year John Green also gave me a present.
Yeah.
And now this year we get the younger brother. Well, and speaking of last year, I know last year I asked y'all what some of your favorite toys were, and I'm just curious if you guys have any, to end on just like a little miscellaneous discussion, if any of you have any favorite more sentimental gifts or not expensive gifts similar to these fun facts. Again, don't give fun facts for the holidays. It's not a good idea.
Every year, my mum gets me a new Christmas decoration.
Aww. My mum does exactly the same thing, by the way, Caroline.
Yeah. Yeah, and I get so sentimental over these decorations that, like, if one gets broken, I'm gonna, like, sit, like when we're decorating the tree and one's broken, I'll just sit there for, like, 10 minutes being like, no, not that decoration. I loved that one. And this year, my mum got me, and for the first time ever, my boyfriend a decoration as well, which is really sweet. So she got us two little glass, like, penguins, because his favourite animal is a penguin. So that's what we got this year. It's so sweet. And if she ever stops doing it, I'm going to cry. So thanks, Mom. I really appreciate the gifts.
We don't get them every year, but... And I think at the time, I just thought, oh, but, like, looking back on it now, it makes me well up, is that there's one or two ornaments on our tree, and I looked... I was looking in the box because we were unpacking them. And I was like, why are there three of this one ornament? And my mom was like, oh, one's for you and your brother eventually to have on your own trees.
Aww.
I was like, oh, my heart.
That's cute. Yeah, my mom does the same thing, Caroline. I always get a new Christmas tree decoration every year, or most years. And they're always really sweet. My mum put so much thought into them. So that's always very nice. Thanks, Mum. I love you.
another gift that me and my friends had a trend of, we love looking up weird custom Pokemon cards that people make online. It's like a habit of ours, and we have a whole, like, Discord thread for them. And so one year I printed it out and then, like, glued it onto a regular Pokemon card and then, like, got, like, those, like, protective, like, films and, like, boxes for, like, a real, like fancy card. And then when they opened it, they were like, god, it's just a nonsense one.
That's so sweet.
All right, I think that's all the grifts we've wrapped.
Let me just have a look on the card on the gift. What does the card say? Oh, it says.
Oh, let me see.
It says Review Corner.
Oh, let me take a look. And it says it's from Caroline took a full gulp of water before that.
I was so confused.
Oh, you did.
I was just
like, what's this,
what
bullshit
the fuck's
gonna be
going on right now? Like,
oh my
I was
God.
Gone for like 5 seconds, and you do had concocted some.
No, we didn't concoct it. It was just passed between us that it would happen that way. We knew.
Wow.
This one is from, it says this gift is from Recensi 7474. And I see in this on the package it came all the way from Belgium, which is wild.
What? Wow, is it chocolate or beer?
It's a review, which is Listen, if you send us chocolate or beer, we will also mention it. Leave a 5-star review or some Stella. their gift says, yeah, science. And they go, great podcast. Gotta love the energy between the hosts. I think I've listened to all of the episodes, and it's always a little bit Christmas when a new one comes out.
Aww.
And we hope, especially for this one. And they also say, sorry if my English is bad. Much love from Belgium.
Literally perfect. It was literally perfect.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
Caroline, do you want to open that other gift that has our plugs in it? I wrapped our plugs.
Oh, I should do that, shouldn't I?
It's the one in the, like, Amazon package that's not even wrapped. I just didn't put much effort into this one.
Just gonna... What is that?
I'm glad we're all having fun with this.
There you go. It's our plugs and shout-outs. Do we have any this week?
You have them. You just open them.
I do have them.
Read them, Caroline.
So let me just first one is...
We call this aggressive improv.
Yes, and.
It's you.
I'm going to shout myself out. My name is Caroline the Bug on all platforms. I'm going to shout Ella out. Ella is Dr. Big Science Energy on TikTok and Ella Hubba on Twitter. And Tom is Tom Lump Person.
And if you've made it this far into the episode, good for you. You have 24 hours, about 24 hours from when this episode drops, to go to our Discord and go to the Q&A channel and ask us a question for the next episode, our end of year Q&A. Go and ask us anything you want within...
It can be as weird as you want it to be,
I don't
honestly.
Know. Don't say that.
You can ask us anything, and it'll be a fun time, so you should definitely do that.
I have one last gift for our wonderful guests who submitted stuff today. I'll plug everyone. Astrid is at Odd Pride. Ash is at Trash Bandicoot. Evelyn is at Evelyn_Volmer. Sabrina is at Nerdy and Quirky. Hank is wikipedia.org/Hank_Green. And that's everyone. That's everyone.
So dumb.
All right.
I love you, Tom, and I love your jokes. I just want you to know that in the spirit of Christmas, of holidays.
You gifted me a lie for Christmas. All right. It's time to do the longest sum up we've ever done.
Oh, Jesus.
So, today, we learned about blah, 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 blah.
And then
blah,
Tom
blah,
spoke of the things they had learned that day.
Things he definitely remembered in great detail, okay? And so, the trio took to...
Go. I love this. What's happening?
And so the trio took to bed with the podcast adjourning, their bellies filled with laughter, their brains filled with learning, and their hearts full of thanks for the friends of the show, and their thanks for MaxFun for being their home, and their thanks for friends and family both near and far, and their thanks for you listening, whoever you are. And yes, even thanks for each other, despite all the bickering. Join us next time, where we're sure to learn...
Everything!
Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted and produced by Ella Hubba, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper, with editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
Everything!
Slam bickering line. With everything?
Yeah, and I tried to make it work, but it didn't.
I loved that.
Everything.
It looked better on paper. It sure
that
did.
That was a wonderful, wonderful poem, Tom.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.